Well, it's a real pleasure having you here. I had, since my adolescence, a fascination with Ambrose Bierce.
Oh.
That is Devil's Dictionary and a number of the supernatural stories and Civil War stories.
Mm.
And I began a book about Bierce, which I've been working on about for 2 or 3 years. Kind of
really?
A fictional. It's set in upstate New York, with Pancho Villa and Bierce sitting on the veranda of a Victorian home.
Yes.
And they're playing Russian roulette all through the book. And it's a series of flashbacks going to his childhood. And since there's not much known about Bierce, I just tried to imagine what his childhood would be like and trying to fill in the gaps. So naturally, I started this before I read The Old Gringo or saw the film, but naturally I was fascinated. And fascinated, too, but when I saw in The Old Gringo all the Bierce allusions all through the book.
Yeah.
I mean, the person who had not read Bierce would not know the line of so many of them, like the man on the white horse is my father.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, yeah,
so it was obvious that you really you knew Bierce's work and how you were able to sprinkle Bierce's lines through that book. It was wonderful.
Yeah, I began reading him when I was 17, so I really had the first idea for the novel. Then I started writing it at 18, then had to stop and began again in the 1960s and finally ended it in the 1980s. It took me a long time for some reason. Maybe because of the mystery surrounding Bierce.
This might act just a little bit. Yeah. You started The Old Gringo when you were 18?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's incredible the way the creative process works.
Yeah.
That you can file away in the computer of your mind the idea of Bierce and have come back to life.
I'm convinced that you end up by writing your first books because you don't know how to write them when you're 18. And you keep them in storage somehow, in the back of your mind, and then when you're 50, 60, you come back to them, and then you can write them, finally. You've learned how to write them.
Well, that's easy for you to say. You've got about 25 novels in your credit.
Yeah. But now I'm writing the books I wanted to write when I was a very young man, you see. I didn't know how to write them then. The Old Gringo was one of them.
But didn't I read someplace that you actually finished The Old Gringo after you had a conversation with Fonda?
Yeah, yeah, more or less, yes. But it was finished practically. Yeah.
That was the impetus to really...
Yeah, it was, because she was interested in making something about the border, and I said, this is a novel that happens on the border. It's not a contemporary situation, or maybe it is, I don't know. But it's about Bierce, yes.
Well, you're here today primarily to talk about The Buried Mirror, which I understand is currently on... is it Bravo? What television channel is it?
Discovery
Channel, that's right. So that was a television series about Spain and the New World, which is also mirrored in a book. So tell me about the project and how it came about.
Well, the project was originated by the Washington-based historian Peggy Liss, who wanted to do a series on Spain and the Golden Age of Spain. Then it grew to an idea of Spanish culture on both sides of the Atlantic. Then they called me in about 8 years ago, and I wrote the scripts for 10 programs, and they shrank to 5 programs. We had difficulty getting funding for it because the interest in Spain and Spanish America is indeed buried, like the mirror of the title. But we finally had the financial resources lined up in 1988, and then we began filming in 89. It's been 3 years' work, the whole process of writing, shooting, editing finally, and now presenting the film, which opens this week on the BBC as well in London.
You were also the host of this broadcast.
Yeah, I'm the host, and I'm the writer, the host, the narrator, yeah.
Now, how does the book fit in with the broadcast?
Well, the book came after the filming, actually. It is a usual thing to have a book that accompanies the series, but the book grew well beyond the idea of the series. It became a kind of personal biography of my culture. I felt I had the opportunity to sit down and write the history of my culture. What do I think about my culture? I almost think it's a right that should be inscribed in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. What do you think about your culture? How does your culture affect you? How do you dream your culture? How do you live it? How do you desire it? So for me, it became a very important book in which I hardly had to consult any other books because it was so deeply within me. I just sat down and wrote it.
It's such a beautiful book with all of the artwork, which I assume is depicted in the film.
That's right, yeah, more or less. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the book and the title, The Buried Mirror, which is fascinating how this title came about. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, yeah. Originally, the idea was, of course, to find a metaphor for a culture that has been hidden, submerged, little known. Although it is the culture of 400 million people in the world, it's in a language, Spanish, which is spoken by a very large number of people. It's the fourth largest language in the world. Yet so little is known about it. In a previous TV series and book, Kenneth Clark's Civilization, he disregarded Spain and Spanish America, saying they have given nothing to history, to civilization. They've only contributed to the story of intolerance, and I'm not talking about any of this. He didn't talk about Cervantes or Goya or Velázquez or Diego Rivera or Orozco or anything. So we found that there was a redressing to be done, and that the image of the buried mirror was a powerful metaphor for what I'm talking about, and besides, it coincided with the discovery of mirrors buried in ceremonies. Colonial sites and burial grounds in the pyramid of El Tajín, the Totonac ruins of El Tajín, the state of Veracruz, where my family comes from, black pyrite, very polished mirrors that were buried in order to guide the dead through the underworld. But then I discovered that, of course, the mirror image was important in both cultures, on both sides of the Atlantics. It is the mirror of Velázquez in Las Meninas. It is Don Quixote fighting against the Knight of the Mirrors. It is Quetzalcoatl, the Indian god, being offered a mirror by Tezcatlipoca, whose name means the smoking mirror, and when seeing himself in the mirror, discovering he has a human face, and therefore a human destiny, and fleeing in horror because of this discovery, finally adds up to my position as a writer and a man of both worlds, of Spain and of the Spanish New Worlds. And since I was very small and I went to Veracruz to see my grandparents, I imagined that the waves of the Atlantic were finally coming to their rest in the Gulf of Mexico in Veracruz, but I could send back the waves from the Americas, from the Gulf of Mexico, back to the Atlantic, through the Atlantic, to the Mediterranean, through Gibraltar. And if I set up a mirror in Mexico, it would reflect Spain. If I set up a mirror in Spain, it would reflect Mexico.
In a way, a culture is based to a high degree on the violence it experiences. Because if a culture is benign, there's sometimes it's said in fiction that fiction is composed of sex and violence. And in a way, in reading The Buried Mirror, that's the impression I got too, that the culture sprang from terrible violence that perpetuated itself for years and years up to almost the present.
Yeah, I think history is violent, and to believe that history and happiness can coincide is more or less fooling oneself. The very, very short periods of human peace and placidity and happiness. Generally, history is strife. That's why I don't believe that history is over, as the current saying goes. I think history is far from over. And after the fall of the Berlin Wall, what have we seen in the last 2 years? We've seen strife. We've seen antagonism. We've seen the return of tribes and idols, things nobody ever expected to see again. We've seen a rise of neo-fascist movements, xenophobia, anti-Semitism, anti-Islamism. So history is far from over. We are unfinished. We have to keep struggling with history, and that is what the book is trying to say. You can make a great culture, but you're going to make it in strife, in difficulty, in violence. That's the way the cookie crumbles, unfortunately.
The conquistadors that you refer to in the book, Cortez, Pizarro, such great men in some respects and such violent men too, and how they with the small numbers of soldiers were able to conquer
the Renaissance was a violent period. Look at Europe, the wars of religion. Look at Cesare Borgia, the writings of Machiavelli, seeing the truth about political relationships based on violence and deceit. The wars that raged through Europe during the Renaissance, denying the humanistic aspirations of the same period. Cortés was typically a man of the Renaissance who brought this spirit. Besides, in the case of Spain, it was an extremely violent and warlike spirit because it was the continuation of 700 years of continuous warfare against the Moors in Spain, within the borders of Spain. Many European nations had no other great conflict in the Middle Ages than going abroad to fight the Crusades. Spain had the Crusade within her own territory fighting against the Moors went over to the New World, and men like Cortes or Valdivia or Almagro fighting in the New World were fighting the same way they would have fought the Moors in the Old World. So it was a continuation of that kind of violence. There is something there, nevertheless, there is a saving grace in the whole Spanish colonization, which is the fact that Spain debates with herself, that Spain creates a century-long debate about the nature of conquest, about just and unjust war, about the right of conquest, about the nature of the people she is subjecting, and she comes up with laws that protected the Indian and agrarian communities of the Americas far better than we have been able to do as independent pseudo-democratic states.
To what degree is there a love-hate relationship between the Hispanic nations and Spain?
There is. There has been, and I think we should overcome it because we are weak without Spain. I fear we are notably weakened without Spain, which besides is the key to the entrance of Latin America into the European common market, into one of the great economic and political blocks of the 21st century. But of course there is a great deal of love-hate antagonism. We struggle with Spain as we struggle with ourselves in a way, and as the way Spain has struggled with herself. Spain has been her own worst antagonist at times as well. But, you know, the recent relationship with Spain is that for most of the century we said, look at that old hag sitting on the steps of a church, smelling of urine and incense, toothless, horrible, probably an old prostitute or go-between. We descend from her. What can we be but the descendants of this horrible being? And suddenly this horrible old hag becomes Marilyn Monroe or Madonna. She's the most beautiful European democracy today. We all want to go to bed with her. So the relationship to Spain has changed because Spain herself has changed. Because Spain is now the most democratic nation of the Spanish-speaking world, after being anything but that during a long, long time.
Now, in the Barry Mirror, you equate many of the Spanish actions in the New World with that of the United States today. Can you explain that?
Yeah, this is an idea that has come from many Spanish historians. The overextension of empire, the fact that Spain created the largest empire the world had ever known, and was so absolutely overextended, fighting on all fronts, totally obsessed with its crusade against the Protestant Reformation, that it finally forgot to solve its own internal problems. Its cities became filled with homeless, with derelicts, with beggars. It had the largest external debt in the world. It had a double deficit, commercial and budget. It forgot education. It forgot the infrastructure. Am I describing the United States today, or am I describing the Spain of Philip III? You tell me.
It sounds familiar.
It does, doesn't it?
I can walk out the front door of my apartment and see the
right
problems.
I'm afraid so.
All around us, that's right. And it's true that in the United States there has not been any sense of real leadership for several administrations, and no leadership on the horizon. It's scary.
It's very scary.
I think it's obvious to most of us who watch these things that there is not going to be a solution to the United States problems in the near future.
No, and it's going to be dramatic. You know, I grew up in your country during the Roosevelt administration when the problems were faced, and the country, the United States, relied upon its most precious capital, which is its people, its human capital, and mobilized them to solve the problems under the leadership of one of the greatest statesmen of the 20th century, Franklin Roosevelt. But you're right, I think that after the death of Kennedy, there's been nothing but mediocrity in the political leadership of the United States. I, like you, do not see anything in the horizon that could make me think otherwise. So one has to be scared, I think, because this is a great nation with a lot of weight in the world and a great role to play in the world. But if it forgets that it has problems inside, that the enemy is inside and no longer outside, unless Captain Ahab comes back and finds the whale in the United States, stranded in the streets of Chicago and Atlanta and Los Angeles, you're going to be in trouble.
Of course, in your book, you're also equally critical of the Latin American countries for their instability, and they are unstable as of this minute. In Peru, for example, they just suspended constitutional liberties.
It's terrible.
And there was big hope for that new president. And it's all crumbling. It's falling apart.
Well, I think the Bush administration created a false illusion, a mirage, that democracy had arrived in Latin America and it was here to stay, and the only undemocratic country was Cuba, therefore you had to single it out. But democracy is very fragile in Latin America because of the great crisis, economic and social crisis we have lived through in the 1980s, the lost decade, as it has been called. And because so many anachronisms persisted, the army, political parties that are no longer representative, and this is set against the best thing we have in Latin America, which is an energetic society organizing itself at the grassroots level. And typically in Peru, what you see is that the society has been crunched between two anachronistic forces, the army, which President Fujimori unfortunately has brought back into power, and an old-style guerrilla insurgency made out of really loony, murderous thugs based on the Khmer Rouge model. So the society is going to suffer between these two forces, yet I hope that eventually we will be able to organize a more democratic society with more social justice and economic development, but it's going to be an uphill fight in Latin America.
As you know, being interested in beers and thus the Mexican Revolution, I found that absolutely fascinating. But it seems to me that Mexico has stabilized to a great degree in the last a number of years. Is that for sure?
Well, Mexico had a deep revolution, a profound revolution. It's the difference between Mexico and the rest of Latin America. The revolution was thoroughgoing. It really changed property relationships, societal relationships. It brought education to masses of people, and it unleashed the forces of the culture. It decided to look at the history of the past, look at itself, and profit from all that we have been. Do not negate anything. The result was the muralists of the 1920s and 30s, the writers, poets, filmmakers, the architects, all that has made Mexican culture and cushioned the tendency towards authoritarian rule. In Mexico, we do have a society again that is growing, that is strengthened, and an able political system. I don't agree with the political system, but I do realize that it's intelligent. It's able. You see, whereas in Peru or Venezuela, the free market reforms were taken without thinking for one moment of the need to cushion them at the level of societal programs. In Mexico, President Salinas carried through free market reforms, but created a movement called Solidarity, which brings electricity and roads and pavements and water to the villages, and he spends half the week in the small villages of Mexico talking to the Indians, talking to the peasants, saying, I'm giving you this, I'm giving you that. So therefore, there's an equilibrium that is lacking in Venezuela or Peru, and therefore you have crisis in those countries, and you have stability in Mexico, to answer your question.
What do you think is going to happen in Cuba? The only real, outside of Albania, I guess, the only real communist state.
I wish I had brought my crystal ball with me, but for one thing, I'm wary. I think that Fidel Castro is a man who entered history in blood and strife and violence and would like to leave history in the same way. I don't see a Cincinnatus there retiring peacefully to the farm, you see. But at the same time, there is this recalcitrant antagonism between the United States and Cuba that makes it very difficult for us, the Latin Americans, to find what we would like to find, diplomatic solutions according to international law that would provoke a change in Cuba little by little. I think really that if any American president between Nixon, or Eisenhower rather, where it all began, between Eisenhower and Bush had embraced Fidel Castro, he would have disappeared in a puff of Havana cigar smoke. But they have been against him, and he has found legitimacy in his own resistance to United States pressures. What we want is a solution based on diplomacy, as I said, on negotiations, so that finally the Cuban people will have a say, because it is up to them, and I think it's particularly up to the youth, the Cuban youth inside Cuba and outside Cuba in the exile communities, who will find the solutions to that country. After all, this is a dictatorship that has lasted 30-odd years, with old dogmas opposed by an old and dogmatic exile leadership in Miami. And it's time for the young people of Cuba, inside and outside the island, to speak and see what they have to say and what they want.
You were born in Panama.
That's right.
Your father was a diplomat, mm-hmm. and you spent a great number of your childhood years in the United States in the Washington area. What was that like?
Well, it was great to be, as I said a moment ago, in Washington during the New Deal years because I saw...
You were so young.
Well, but nevertheless, I was in a diplomatic and political milieu. And besides, I was going to school, and I was going to a school that was multiracial, multicultural. I had... Chinese, Greek, Polish, black companions at school. A lot of Jews fleeing from Hitler were arriving, young men, young women, 9, 10 years old. So besides, we were very well educated in the public schools in the United States in the 1930s. The three things I learned in public school when I was 5, 6, 7 years old and have never forgotten our geography, history, and literature. Today, these things are not taught in the public schools, another problem for the United States. But we were very politicized at that moment, even as kids. And there were, and I was in a diplomatic and political family, and we talked about these things over the dining table. So I saw a country that I admire enormously because it lived up to its ideals. This is the America of Roosevelt, is a United States that lived up to the ideals it proclaimed, which is a very difficult thing to do, but you managed it then. You did it then.
Well, the next phase of your life was out of Washington and in South America. Where exactly?
In Chile and Argentina.
Chile and Argentina.
Two very important countries for me, yes.
And at some point, I guess you had to declare what your future was going to be, and I think that at an early age you knew pretty well that you wanted to be a writer.
Yeah. Ever since I was 7 years old, I started scribbling things. I started publishing my first stories and essays when I was 11, 12 in Chile in Spanish. So
publishing them where?
In the bulletin of the National Institute of Chile, which is a great institution, a great publication created by the liberal Chilean intelligentsia in the 19th century, and that was constantly looking for expressions from young Latin Americans, even children, you know. It published a children's page, and I was on it when I was very little.
What did you write?
I wrote Mexico. I tried to give Chileans an idea of Mexico and how I understood and loved the country.
When you went on to get your degree, did you opt for literature, English? Not English, I shouldn't say English, Spanish.
No, I'm a lawyer, you know.
I know, you went on, I know
because,
you became a lawyer.
Because you cannot be, my parents told me you can't be a writer unless you're also a lawyer,
but
or you have to die of hunger.
You have to pursue law as an advanced degree, right? So you have an undergraduate degree as well.
Yeah, a preparatory school, you mean. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, that was quite Catholic, universal. In Mexico City.
Mm-hmm. And so that was general education, studies?
Yeah, very general studies, very good general studies, literature, history, geography, physics, science, everything.
So,
yeah.
But you actually did apply your legal background. You became a diplomat.
And that's right, yes.
And you had a number of diplomatic posts. Tell me about that.
Well, it comes from in my blood, I guess, because my father was a career diplomat for all his life, for 30 years. So I was close to that world. I'm always being interested in international affairs. And only in two periods of my life, when I was very young and starting to write and had to support myself, I was in the diplomatic service. And then later, when I didn't need it, but did it because almost I wanted it as an homage to my dead father, I accepted the embassy in Paris, and I was there for 2 years. But I was itching to get back to writing, which is what I really loved.
It must have been a wonderful experience.
And France is a great country, Paris, and I loved it enormously. I have no complaints, but finally writing is my world. It's where I wanted to come back to.
Well, at what point in your life did you decide that your roots were in Mexico and you decided to make your home there?
No, I've always thought my roots were in Mexico because even living in the United States, every summer I went back to Mexico to see my grandparents, whom I loved very much, my grandmothers. And so I was going back and forth constantly, spending 3 months of the year in Mexico. I never lost those roots. For me, it was always a clear question of being Mexican. And, of course, in moments of tension in the United States, between the United States and Mexico, I was meant to feel that I was a stranger, a Mexican by American school kids in my school, who suddenly, being my friends, turned their backs on me because there were blaring headlines that Mexico was a communist country that expropriated the oil wells, etc. And then I came back to their friendship, but I realized in all of this that I was a Mexican, and a fiery Mexican, because let me tell you, at 10, my father took me to see a film on the life of Sam Houston, the RK O'Keefe in Washington, the Alamo, Texas, all this. And I suddenly had to get up in my seat and scream at the top of my 10-year-old lungs, long live Mexico, death to the gringos. Whereupon my father carted me out of the cinema very quickly.
Of course, there was a reverse to that, too. In Mexico, you were looked upon one as a Mexican who was brought up away from Mexico.
Yeah.
Reverse of that. Well, tell me about your earliest published writing and your first novel and how that came about.
Well, first I published a book of short stories, The Masked Days, Los Días Enmascarados, in 1954, and it was a hit. It was a bestseller. It was sold very, very quickly. And that gave me a basis on which to tell my parents, listen, I've had a little success. Please help me a bit while I finish my novel, which I was beginning by then, which was called Where the Air is Clear, La Región Más Transparente. And that, too, was a very big success when I published it. I was 28 years old. And it was considered to be the first novel about modern Mexico City, about a picture of a city and the new social classes and the new conflicts that had arisen in what was to become a basically metropolitan, urban society, which had until then been described basically as a rural society full of Pancho Villas and Zapatas and big hats and guns and cactus. It was a modern society full of contradictions. This is what I wrote about in the first novel, and it established a certain date in Mexican history, in Mexican literature.
You are so fluent in English, but you do write in Spanish.
I write in Spanish. I write novels in Spanish, literature in Spanish, because, as I've said many times, I only dream in Spanish. And but I can write essays in English. The Buried Mirror is written in English originally. You know, I translated myself into Spanish, but the book is written in English originally.
Now, who generally does your translation?
Oh, I have very good translators in several languages. There are only two languages in which I can control the translation, which are French and English. But then when you get into Lithuanian and Turk and Japanese, well, I'm in the hands of the translators. Once I was translated, one of my novels, The Death of Artemio Cruz, was translated into Russian and published in Moscow. But it was a 400-page book, which became a 200-page book. So I inquired, what happened? Why did the book slim down that way? Wasn't it sampharized? And they said, oh, no, we cut out half of it. And I said, what? What parts? He said, oh, everything that had to do with sex and politics. I said, there's nothing left then. All the book is about sex and politics. He said, no, you misunderstand us. We did it to favor you because we understand what the Russian public likes and what it doesn't like. So we took out everything that would be considered offensive to the Soviet public. And I wish they would restore that translation now that there is a degree of freedom in the Soviet Union.
Don't you love people who understand what we like and are going to protect us from ourselves by cutting out the things we
lovely,
should not
isn't
see?
It?
Isn't that great?
Great.
What degree of censorship is there in Mexico?
I don't think there's a censorship for books. There's no censorship. You can publish anything you damn well like in a book. And practically in a newspaper as well. It's in television that you find more than censorship, self-censorship. There is a quasi-monopoly of private television in Mexico in which nobody who has any opinion that is critical is ever admitted, and where you never hear the voice of the opposition and things like that. But that is done as an homage to power, you know, by the owner of the channel, Emilio Azcárraga. So it's simply a decision based on self-censorship and lack of guts, I guess, and opportunism.
Of course, in the United States, one has to be eternally vigilant and fight off the censors because they're everywhere. Okay. But there has not been a successful censorship of a book for many years.
No.
And I was reading
in Mexico,
no. Liberty Grazia wrote a. He was a lawyer, and he won the Lady Chatterley's lover case in this country.
Mm-hmm.
He's been fighting censorship issues for years and years, and I was reading his book, and I noticed that they don't censor violence, blood. Pestilence, epidemics, this sort of thing. They're only interested in censoring sex.
That's right. I think it's Freud should say something about that. The ghost of Dr. Freud should come back and speak about this. The persecution of Robert Mapplethorpe in Life and After by Jesse Helms is indecent. Why doesn't he persecute Michelangelo, who also had male nudes?
He would have.
I'm sure you're right. You're absolutely right. Very good answer.
And in the Reagan administration, one of the most successful areas that it had was the Mies Commission on Pornography, and they managed to get the 7-Eleven convenience stores, mostly in the South, not to carry Playboy.
Yeah.
And you wonder, all of the things you mentioned a while ago, the homeless and the and economic problems, and we've got AIDS and all of these things, and they're interested in knocking Playboy out of the 7-Eleven store.
It's ridiculous. But politicians can be very ridiculous, especially when they think they are they're answering to a constituency, a hard rock conservative constituency which elects them, and this can be terrible. But there are also a lot of hang-ups in any society about these matters. They will accept the Michelangelo, but they won't accept Mapplethorpe. And sometimes it becomes ridiculous. In France right now, I find it ridiculous that intellectuals are signing manifestos against Disneyland. Who's afraid of Mickey Mouse, after all? It's not serious. If a culture is not strong enough to resist Mickey Mouse, then it's very weak. And if it's not strong enough to take a picture by Mapplethorpe and understand that it is an expression of art, of extending the margins of expression, of exploration of human possibilities and relationships and manifestations and expressions, well, they're wrong.
Now, you're well known for your left-wing politics, and for years and years you were barred from the United States.
Yeah.
I guess they thought your ideas would come and corrupt us innocents from places like where I come from, Kansas. You know, come here and all of a sudden we would be corrupted by your ideas. Tell me about how you felt about that.
Well, I felt very ridiculous because there you are, all the books were published. The most explosive things I can say in a book. When I come personally here, what can I do if I don't go and blow up a post office or something of the sort? I'm usually having a good time with my friends and going to bookstores and films and theater and galleries and other things I enjoy in the United States. So it is an absolutely McCarthyite, ridiculous thing that put the United States in a very bad light, especially as a signer of the Helsinki Agreement, asking the Soviet Union for free communication and movement of persons and ideas, and forbidding it in the United States. I have to tell you that the list drawn up by the Justice and State Departments was a very distinguished list. You had Gabriel Garcia Marquez, Yves Montand, Iris Murdoch, Graham Greene, Dario Fo. So I would have been insulted if I hadn't been on that list. Well, I also have to say that I admire very much all the people who defended us, who fought against the exclusion clause of the McCarran-Walter Act, the Penn Club of the United States, Norman Mailer, people in Congress like Barney Frank, Edward Kennedy, Elizabeth Holtzman. They were extraordinarily helpful in defeating this law and sending it to where it belongs, which is hell.
How long were you on this list?
Oh, for an unconscionable number of years, since 1962 until 2 years ago.
Is this your first visit?
No, because I've been given waivers. One of them was given to me by Robert Kennedy in 1964, and with the proviso that I come to Manhattan and do not leave the island of Manhattan. It was only for 5 years, limited to Manhattan Island. I remember that Norman Mailer went to get me at my hotel and said, "You can't come to my home in Brooklyn." I said, "No, I can't. It's forbidden by the law, by the visa." Said, we'll flaunt that. So he took me in the most crazy ride over the bridges to get me into Brooklyn, followed by an FBI guy or CIA, whatever he was, dressed in a trench coat and a slouch hat, when we promptly dubbed Humphrey. And Humphrey never left us. He was always there, you know. But 5 days later, I had to leave the country. But then, after I was banned from leaving ship in Puerto Rico, in San Juan, and my landing card was ripped by a U.S. immigration officer. There was a big rumpus in this country, an editorial in the New York Times, the Penn Club, all the things I've said, especially in the Senate, so it was taken up and got a defense and was granted a waiver from then on. So I applied for a waiver, made the bureaucracy work twice, because first I applied for a visa. I was denied the visa on the grounds of the McCarran-Walter Act. Then I applied for the waiver, and I was given the visa. So I was spending taxpayers' money uselessly twice.
Allen Ginsberg was telling me that in the 1960s, whenever he left the country and he would come back, at the airport when he went through customs, he would always have to undergo strip searches.
Strip searches.
Strip searches.
My God.
Because they were...
That's a real violation of
contraband
his rights.
Or drugs or...
Yeah.
You know, but it was political, you understand.
Mm-hmm.
It was political. they were afraid of people who were different. And
yeah.
certainly Alan,
yeah.
especially in the past, when he yeah. was in his beat days,
yes.
wore his hair long and he wore strange clothes and bells and things
yeah.
like that.
Yeah.
He looked strange.
Yeah.
He looks straight now. He wears dark suits, very professorial. But it was humiliating, but he did it anyway, because he wanted to travel. But
yeah.
to have to undergo
yeah.
strip searches every time he went back to the airport was...
Well, I consider that quite violatory of basic rights, you know. Hmm?
Well, of course it is, but how do you stop it? I mean,
well,
we give politicians and the government
yeah.
In this country and every country a
yeah.
great deal of power.
Yeah.
And often you can do something to stop the misuse of power, but it's often too late.
Yeah.
I mean, it's after the fact.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can stop them. But yeah. meanwhile, you're going to go strip search or you're...
Oh, well, and these things happen. Listen, we're talking about the ideological exclusion clause of the McCain-Walter Act. And between the moment it was passed in the Eisenhower administration until the Carter administration, there were only about 3,000 people on that list. During the Reagan administration, it climbed to 30,000. I mean, the Reagan administration was capable of finding about 30,000 people who were worthy of being excluded from the United States in a period of 8 years. I consider that fantastic.
Well,
almost from an arithmetical point of view.
Well, think how safe and uncorrupted I was.
Imagine.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I'd like to ask you, you live in Mexico City?
And London.
And London, too?
Yeah.
Mexico. I haven't been to Mexico City for many years, since the early 70s, I
guess. Yeah.
Beautiful city, but I've heard all about the, mm-hmm. the pollution problem
yes.
it's having, and people
yes.
can only drive so many days a week.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like living in Mexico City now?
It's difficult because of all the problems you're saying. The big problem is not applying Band-Aids. It has to do with the bad quality of gasoline and diesel. As long as this is the case, we'll have pollution in Mexico City with 2 million cars moving around spouting poison all day. So it's not the number of cars, it's the quality of the emissions of the gasoline and diesel use. As long as this, for political and economic reasons, is not taken care of, we will suffer in Mexico, a city which is beautiful and we love it. And it's a monster because in my lifetime it has gone from 1 million to 19 million people in one man's lifetime. You have to keep inside your house and do your work there and don't go out too much. As soon as you hit the freeways, you're crying, coughing, feeling ill. But I think it's a question of political will on the part of the government and also of citizen will. We, the citizens, have to do something about it, beginning with our own little problems of not throwing waste around, etc. So also there's something favorable, which is the decentralizing impetus in the country, in Mexico. More and more people are going away, going to other cities, living in other parts of the country. The country is decentralizing, not through fiat, not through edict, but in a natural, spontaneous way. That could help the problems of the city. But as long as there is no political solution to the problem of the quality of the gasoline and diesel, we'll be in trouble.
And lastly, tell me about the typical day for Carlos Fuentes. Or is there such a thing?
There is such a thing. Now you know, thanks to Houghton Mifflin and my lovely friend Barbara Cave, I do not live a normal life. I jump from one place to another and do 10 things at the same time, and I'm convinced that I'm ubiquitous at last. But basically, normally, indeed, I get up early, I do exercise, I take my shower, I have breakfast, and I start working around 8 o'clock, work from 8 to 1, have lunch, read from 3 to 6, and then the day is mine. 24 hours is a long time every day.
You never run out of ideas?
No. I have long projects for from here till kingdom come, you know.
Doesn't sound to me like you're going to get bored in the near future.
I've never been bored.
Well, The Buried Mirror is a beautiful, beautiful book, beautifully illustrated by Carlos Fuentes. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much for having me.